From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
This has been a long, challenging few weeks for Congress and for the country. It's my hope that today we can put some of those most urgent issues behind us. After yesterday's events, the Majority Leader and I began a series of conversations about a way to get the government reopened and to prevent default. I'm confident we'll be able to do both those things later today. Crucially, I'm also confident that we'll be able to announce that we're protecting the government's spending reductions that both parties agreed to under the Budget Control Act, and that the President signed into law. That's been a top priority for me and for my colleagues on the Republican side of the aisle throughout this debate, and it's been worth the effort. Some have suggested that we break that promise as part of this agreement. Some have said Washington needs to spend more, that we need to raise taxes, that we need to just tax our way to prosperity and balance. But what the BCA showed is that Washington actually can cut spending. And because of this law, that's just what we've done. For the first time since the Korean War, government spending has declined for 2 years in a row. The first time in 50 years. And we're not going back on this agreement. There's a lot more we need to do to get our nation's fiscal house in order. Hopefully, once we've gotten past the drama of the moment, we can get to work on it. But for now, let's not understate the importance of the Budget Control Act or the importance of the fight to preserve it. This legislation is the largest spending reduction bill of the last quarter century and the largest deficit reduction bill since 1981. That didn't include a tax hike. Preserving this law is critically important to the future of our country. Throughout this debate, the public is rightly focused on Obamacare, for good reason. This law is ravaging our economy, killing jobs, driving up premiums, and driving people off the health care plans they have and like in droves. Its disastrous rollout is a sign of even worse things to come. And the refusal to delay it reflects a kind of stubborn ideological obsession that will do untold damage to our country. And Republicans remain determined to repeal this terrible law. But for today, the relief we hope for is to reopen the government, avoid default, and protect the historic cuts we achieved under the Budget Control Act. This is far less than many of us had hoped for, frankly, but it's far better than what some had sought. Now it's time for Republicans to unite behind other crucial goals. Madam President, I yield the floor.
That was Republican Senate Leader Mitch McConnell commenting earlier on a bipartisan deal struck in the Senate today with the Democratic majority. The Senate Democratic Leader Harry Reid said that while there has been what he called, quote, a great deal of political discord, close quote, in the Congress on display for weeks.
Today they will also see Congress reach a historic bipartisan agreement to reopen the government and avert a default on the nation's bills. The compromise we reached will provide our economy with the stability it desperately needs. It's never easy for two sides to reach consensus. It's really hard, sometimes harder than others. This time was really hard. But after weeks spent facing off across a partisan divide that often seemed too wide to cross, our country came to the brink of a disaster. But in the end, political adversaries set aside their differences and disagreements to prevent that disaster. I thank the Republican leader for his diligent efforts to reach this important agreement. Republican leaders' cooperation was essential to reach an accord that could pass both chambers of Congress and also be signed by President Obama. As part of our agreement, in order to assure Congress continues the work of setting this country on a path of fiscal sustainability, this legislation instructs leaders to name conferees to a budget conference committee that will set our country on a long-term path to fiscal sustainability. Madam President, I know that some say that's going to be hard. But what we do is hard here, and this is really hard, but I think we can get it done. The committee members selected must have open minds, be willing to consider every option, no matter how painful to their own political ideas and even their own political parties. This conference committee, led by Chairman Murray and Chairman Ryan, which will produce its negotiated budget resolution in December, is the appropriate place to discuss our different views of the best way to chart a course for economic growth. This legislation also funds the government through January 15th and averts default through February 7th, during which time we can work toward a long-term budget agreement that prevents these frequent crises. And perhaps most importantly, this legislation ends a standoff that ground the work of Washington to a halt this fall. Madam President, this is not a time for pointing fingers or blame. This is a time of reconciliation. I look forward to working with my colleagues on both sides of this great capital to pass this remarkable agreement, which will protect the long-term health of our economy and avert a default on our nation's debt and allow us to set a foundation for economic expansion. What we've done is sent a message to Americans from every one of our 50 states. In addition to that, the citizens of every country in the world, that the United States lives up to its obligations. Now Congress must return to its most important job, fostering economic growth and protecting middle-class families. I appreciate through all this the steady hand of President Obama who helped guide us to this conclusion. I'm optimistic that the spirit of compromise that has taken root in the Senate over the last 2 days will endure. I do know this. Senator McConnell and I have sat in very, very serious discussions the last few days. We're going to do everything we can to change the atmosphere in the Senate and accomplish things that need to be done for our country.
The deal would keep the government open through at least January 15th, according to the Associated Press, and the debt ceiling would be raised through February 7th. It will face a vote in the Senate first. Apparently, the opposition from the Tea Party wing of McConnell's party will not block that vote. Senator Ted Cruz, whose now infamous Dr. Seuss filibuster drew the attention of an incredulous world, has said he will not offer a repeat performance. He spoke at a press conference after the deal was announced. He also used the opportunity to once again rail against the Affordable Health Care Act, more popularly known as Obamacare.
Unfortunately, once again, it appears the Washington establishment is refusing to listen to the American people. The deal that has been cut provides no relief to the millions of Americans who are hurting because of Obamacare. The deal that has been cut provides no relief to all the young people coming out of school who can't find a job because of Obamacare. It provides no relief to all the single parents who have been forced into part-time work, struggling to feed their kids on 29 hours a week. It provides no relief to all the hardworking families who are facing skyrocketing health insurance premiums. And it provides no relief to all the seniors, to all the people with disabilities who are right now getting in the mail notifications from their health insurance companies that they're losing their health insurance because of Obamacare. It is unfortunate that Washington is not listening to the people. Now, I want to commend the House of Representatives. The House of Representatives has taken a bold stance listening to the American people, but unfortunately, the United States Senate has refused to do likewise. The United States Senate has stayed with the traditional approach of the Washington establishment of maintaining the status quo and doing nothing to respond to the suffering that Obamacare is causing millions of Americans. This is unfortunate, but nobody should be surprised that the Washington establishment is pushing back. Nobody should be surprised at the resistance to change. Let me say, the American people in the last few months have risen up in overwhelming numbers. We've seen millions of Americans all over this country working to change Washington. That has been incredible progress, and this fight, this debate will continue until collectively the American people can make D.C. listen, can get real relief for all of the people who were hurt because of Obamacare. You want to know what this fight is about? It's about one thing. It is about all of the people across this country who are right now facing terrifying decisions because they're losing their health care, they're losing their jobs, they're being left in the cold. And sadly, the United States Senate has said, Washington will do nothing. It has created the problems you're facing, but Washington will do nothing to address the suffering you're feeling. That is unfortunate. But this debate and this fight will continue in the months ahead.
Senator, there's a two-part question here. Number one, will you filibuster?
And what's the second part?
The second part is, if you're not going to filibuster, will you take a significant amount of time that is not a true filibuster to punt this into tomorrow?
Look, there have been many questions about the timing of this vote. The timing of this vote, it is my understanding from leadership, is likely to occur today. I have no objections to the timing of this vote. And the reason is simple. There's nothing to be gained from delaying this vote one day or 2 days. The outcome will be the same. Every senator, every member of the House is going to have to make a decision where he or she stands. But there's no benefit. I've never had any intention of delaying the timing of this vote. And indeed, I thought it was interesting reading in the papers that much speculation about whether we might delay the timing of the vote. Republican leadership never asked if I intended to delay the timing of the vote. My focus is on the substance. My focus is, I think, where the American people's focus is, which is what are we doing to provide real relief to the people who are hurting because of Obamacare? And unfortunately, today, the answer is the United States Senate and the Washington establishment is doing nothing to provide relief for the millions of people who are hurting because of Obamacare.
Can I ask you about where we are right now? As you well know, you have a lot of fellow Republicans really downright angry at you because here we are almost 3 weeks later. The strategy that you started out on to defund Obamacare as part of funding the government, they never thought was going to work because the votes aren't there. And here we are reopening the government after a lot of bruising political warfare internally, and you've got nothing for it.
Well, Dana, respectfully, I disagree with the premise of that. I think we have seen a remarkable thing happen. Months ago, when the effort to defund Obamacare began, official Washington scoffed. They scoffed that the American people would rise up. They scoffed that the House of Representatives would do anything, and they scoffed that the Senate would do anything. We saw, first of all, millions upon millions of Americans rise up all over this country, over 2 million people signing a national petition to defund Obamacare. We saw the House of Representatives take a courageous stand listening to the American people that everyone in official Washington just weeks earlier said would never happen. That was a remarkable victory to see the House engage in a profile in courage. Unfortunately, the Senate chose not to follow the House. And in particular, we saw real division among Senate Republicans. That was unfortunate. I would point out that had Senate Republicans united and supported House Republicans, the outcome of this, I believe, would have been very, very different. I wish that had happened, but it did not. But it does give a path going forward that if the American people continue to rise up, I believe the House will continue to listen to the American people, and I hope in time the Senate begins to listen to the American people also. Because, look, lots of people in Washington love to focus on the politics. It is, unfortunately, the game of this town. But what matters more than any politicians in Washington is all of the people across this country who are hurting right now, who are getting in the mail a notification that the health care they're relying on for their care, for their parents' care, for their children's care, that it's being canceled because of Obamacare. President Obama promised the American people Obamacare would lower your health insurance premiums. I would venture to say virtually every person across this country has seen exactly the opposite happen, has seen premiums going up and up and up, and everyone who clicks on Obamacare and sees the premiums going up and up and up. President Obama promised the American people, if you like your health insurance, you can keep it. We now know that statement was flat out categorically false. People all over this country are losing their health insurance. 15,000 UPS employees got a notification in the mail that they were losing spousal coverage, that their husbands and wives were all losing the health insurance that they wanted and they liked. That is happening all over the country. It's wrong. And the focus, in my view, should not be on the politics of Washington. The politics of Washington at the end of the day doesn't matter. What the focus should be is on making Washington, D.C. listen to the American people and respond to the very real harms that Obamacare is causing to millions of people. Thank you very much.
With the backing of the leadership of both parties, the measure is expected to pass a vote, which should come early this evening. House approval, however, is also required. Earlier today, Representative Kevin Brady, a Texas Republican who chairs the Joint Economic Committee, discussed House Speaker John Boehner's comments that it would bring up a vote in the House if the Senate reached an agreement to end the debt ceiling debate.
I haven't talked to the Speaker this morning. He's made it clear to the House that if agreement is reached in the Senate, it is coming to the vote in a very timely way. I don't know that a decision has been made that the House would lead on a Senate Republican and Democrat agreement.
He was asked how he thought Tea Party members would react.
You know, I would imagine they don't like it or support it. Clearly, changes to the Affordable Care Act was a high priority going into this. Even as late as yesterday, we were hoping to really end some of the special treatment lawmakers in the White House get in this, as well as repeal some of the taxes within that bill. We couldn't unite on those issues. So if you don't get 218 in the House, frankly, you take, unfortunately, whatever the Senate gives you.
When asked if he thought Boehner would face a challenge from Tea Party members as Speaker, he said,
well, you know, that's almost an entirely different issue from this. Let's focus on how we meet this debt ceiling deadline, how we handle reopening government, how we solve the bigger issue.
One questioner pushed the point and asked that if it went through and the right was not happy, how would they react?
Well, it is difficult to say. What I do know is House Republicans are learning a lesson that without 218 votes, we have very little say in the way this government is run. And unless we unite behind what we believe in, which is a smaller government, fixing the entitlements and tax reform, we're going to find ourselves in this position way too often.
Brady was asked directly if he thought Boehner would bring it to the floor and put it to a full vote of the House, and would it pass? And he said this.
First, I'm not the Speaker. I don't represent the whole Republican caucus. But two, I believe that that is what will happen, that the Speaker will bring that agreement to the House floor in a very timely manner. We think it's important to meet those debt ceiling deadlines, as well as reopen the government itself.
Meanwhile, White House spokesperson Jay Carney held a press conference after the Senate agreement was announced. He was asked what steps were in place today in case the two houses of Congress were unable to pass a bill before the debt limit deadline of midnight expired.
Since we are so close to that deadline, are there any operations or procedures that are going in place today to prepare for the possibility that Congress cannot pass this measure today?
The Treasury is the place that would answer questions like that. What I can tell you is what Secretary Lew has made clear in his testimony and in his letter to Congress, and that is that the Treasury Department will exhaust borrowing authority at the end of the day tomorrow, Thursday, October 17th. And that beyond that point, the Treasury would have only cash on hand. It would not be able to borrow new money to meet obligations.
He was also asked if the White House was confident that the bill would pass both houses.
We are not putting odds on anything. We're simply applauding the leaders of the Senate for reaching the agreement that they've reached and calling on both houses of Congress to act swiftly, to take action to ensure that the government reopens and the threat of default is removed, and that the continuing harm that these two situations have caused to our economy can stop.
When asked if the president had fulfilled his pledge not to negotiate on the health care bill, Carney seemed to pivot.
The president has said from the beginning that he would not negotiate on this. Now that it looks like there is a deal, do you feel like he fulfilled that pledge?
What the president made clear was his position is that he would not allow a situation to develop where he paid ransom to any party in Congress that was trying to extract unilateral political concessions in return for Congress fulfilling its fundamental responsibilities. And he believes that's the right position for him to take, that it was the right position, it is the right position, and it's the right position for presidents of the future to take, because our economy is extremely dependent on the faith and credit that is invested in it by investors around the world. In other words, there is a real, even if intangible, value to the safeness of investing in the United States. And as we've discussed many times over the past days and weeks, threatening that does real harm. And obviously, default would cause even more harm. But we've already seen, there is already a price that has been paid, as we saw in October, in 2011, and we've seen again now in the various ways that the flirtation with crossing that line and flirting with default has brought about consequences. So he felt and feels that it's the right position to take, and again applauds the leaders of the Senate for coming together and working out a bipartisan solution.
The votes are being taken after press time today, but we will examine the results of the Senate and House votes and the impacts of the deadlock tomorrow. However, some effects have already been felt, which may continue to plague the U.S. economy regardless of the outcome today. In one example, the China Daily ran its top story today under the headline, "Experts Eye Cutback in China's Massive Stock of T-Bills." Earlier today, it said that more Chinese economists were beginning to sound the alarm over the risk to China of holding more than $1 trillion in U.S. Treasury bills. The article said that even if the debt impasse is eventually solved before tonight's deadline, the political brinksmanship unfolding on the world stage and the tremendous uncertainty around it reminded Chinese economists and media of the risk of excessive exposure to U.S. Treasury bills. Li Daqui, a former policy advisor to the central bank and a prominent economist at Tsinghua University, suggested in an article in the Financial Times today that China should reduce its exposure to U.S. sovereign bonds. He said, quote, "Many argue that China has few alternatives to investing in U.S. debt, but I don't think this is true," closed quote. The bulk of China's foreign exchange reserves, which reached $3.66 trillion by the end of last month, is held in U.S. Treasury bonds. Though China has never officially disclosed the exact amount, Li and others believe China is the largest overseas creditor, with at least $1.28 trillion. Li said that one possible alternative would be to sell half of the current holdings and reorient them to three different kinds of financial assets. One would be the stock of multinationals that have invested in the Chinese market. He called that the equivalent of investing in its own economy. Another is to invest in other economies' sovereign debts with a higher rating than AA+. The third choice is utility corporations in mature economies. He said the only explanation that China continues to hold such a gigantic share of U.S. debt is out of broader concern for U.S.-China relations. But he said, quote, "No one can guarantee that the government can resist the domestic pressure, especially from economists who have called for diversified investment and smaller U.S. Treasuries buying," closed quote. Chinese media have gone even further, with Xinhua News Agency saying, quote, "What may also be included as a key part of an effective reform is the introduction of a new international reserve currency that is to be created to replace the dominant U.S. dollar," closed quote. Nearly two centuries after England freed its slaves, 14 Caribbean countries are suing England, France, and the Netherlands for slavery, seeking billions in reparations. They claim that the legacy of the slave trade continues today, with shocking poverty across the Caribbean. The British law firm Lay Day has been hired to represent the Caribbean countries. Lay Day recently won reparations for hundreds of Kenyans who were tortured by the British government in the 1950s. CPR's Abiyomi Ezekwe, the editor of the Pan-African Journal, gave CPR this report.
The Caribbean community, CARICOM, says that the underdevelopment in the region is a direct result of the legacy of involuntary servitude. Britain is being sued with France and the Netherlands by 14 Caribbean countries demanding that what could be hundreds of billions of pounds in reparations for slavery. This is reported in an article by the Daily Mail that is printed in London. The article is written by Tom Leonard and Simon Tomlinson. It was published on October the 10th. The article says that around 175 years after Britain freed its last slaves in the West Indies, an alliance of Caribbean nations is demanding to be repaid for the, quote, awful, unquote, lingering legacy of the Atlantic slave trade. Now, CARICOM, a group of 12 former British colonies, together with the former French colony of Haiti and the Dutch-held Suriname, believes the European government should pay, and the UK in particular. It has hired the British law firm Lay Day, which recently won compensation for hundreds of Kenyans tortured by the British colonial government during the Kenyan Land and Freedom Army Rebellion that took place between 1952 and 1956, and the consequent containment of hundreds of thousands of Africans in Kenya in concentration camps between 1956 and 1960. CARICOM has not specified how much money they will seek, but senior officials have pointed out that Britain paid slave owners £20 billion when it abolished slavery in 1834. That sum would be equivalent today of £200 billion. Now, in the United States, the idea of reparations has surfaced a number of times over the years, but have never been paid out to the descendants of Africans who were enslaved in the United States between the 17th and the middle of the 19th century. At the end of the Civil War, around 400,000 acres of land in Florida, Georgia, and South Carolina were taken from former slave owners and earmarked for the freed Africans who had been enslaved. But the decision was reversed by President Andrew Johnson after President Abraham Lincoln's assassination in April of 1865. And this has been noted in many historical accounts in regard to the Civil War and the period of Reconstruction inside the United States. In 2008, Barack Obama said he did not support reparations to the descendants of African slaves, going against the views of around two dozen members of Congress who sponsored legislation to create a commission on the impact and the economic fallout of the Atlantic slave trade and the system of chattel slavery inside the United States. In the same year, the House apologized for slavery, with the Senate following suit in 2009, but neither mentioned any idea in regard to monetary or any other form of compensation. In its lawsuit, CARICOM claims slavery condemned the region to a poverty that still afflicts it today, and they are comparing their demand to Germany's recompensing Jewish people for the Holocaust, and New Zealand compensated the Maoris, the indigenous people of that South Pacific nation. The awful legacy of these crimes against humanity ought to be repaired for the developmental benefit of our Caribbean societies and all our peoples. And that is according to Ralph Gonsalves, the Prime Minister of the tiny St. Vincent and Grenadines Islands. He called it a, quote, historic wrong that has to be righted, unquote. Fareen Shepherd, who is coordinating Jamaica's demand for reparations, said their slave ancestors got nothing when they were freed. They got their freedom and they were told, go develop yourselves, she said.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.